Beyond the Stethoscope, the podcast for veterinarians, healthcare providers, and busy professionals who want actionable, implementable solutions surrounding work-life balance, accomplishing your goals, and living your dreams. I'm your host, Dr. Angela Demery.
We are here today with Danusha Lipinski. For over 33 years, Danusha has been working with immigrants, their families, the employers who hire them, and agricultural and seasonal employers. Danusha is the CEO and founder of Myrtle Beach Immigration Law Office. As a longtime member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, a nonpartisan national organization, Danusha served on the Board of Governors and also worked as an associate director of advocacy. Danusha has been recognized locally and nationally as a passionate advocate on behalf of immigrants and the dire need for changes in our immigration laws to meet demands in global economy. More recently, Danusha's passion has turned to being a transformational change agent to those who feel their lives have lost meaning or purpose and who are going through the motions of life rather than living a life they would really love living. As a certified Dream Builder coach with the Brave Thinking Institute and certification as a high performance coach through the High Performance Institute, Danusha focuses on helping people create a vision of the life they would love living in their health and well-being, their relationships, their vocation, and in time and money freedom. Her clients learn to live from their vision with clarity and in alignment with their true heart's desire. Danusha earned her JD from the Golden Gate University in 1983 and is licensed in Colorado and California. Prior to becoming a lawyer, Danusha was an auto worker and an elementary education teacher, and it was her work as an auto worker that propelled her to go to law school. Well, welcome, Danusha. How are you today?
I am wonderful, and I thank you so much for this opportunity, Angela, to be with you today.
So much great experience. And I have to ask, what was it as your work as an auto worker that propelled you to go to law school? What an interesting career path.
It is. Whoever would have expected it. Actually, the union, the UAW, was not representing the workers. They would tie me when I went to the bathroom. They would put me way back in the plant. I have kerosene burns on my hands and on my legs. So the union wasn't... union management was not representing us. And of course, Ford Motor Company was not taking good care of us either. So we filed a lawsuit. We filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. And that process was amazing. It was fascinating to me how the questions that they asked and just the process. So when I was laid off, I thought, maybe I want to be a paralegal, but maybe I should just go ahead and be the lawyer instead. So I went to law school. So I was going to become a labor lawyer, but immigration called me instead.
Okay. Wow. Well, such an interesting career path. And I think that's so often how we all get interested in our careers is that we are exposed to something and we learn and we're like, oh, wow, that's super interesting. I'd love to learn more about it. So was it just your curiosity that sent you down this path to becoming a lawyer?
No, I think that I have an advocate's heart. Some people have said that I have a servant's heart, but I'm definitely passionate and I'm definitely an advocate. So when I saw what was not only happening to me, but also what was happening to other workers in the plant, and there were not that many women workers at the time, because this is way back in the late 70s, early 80s, I decided that watching the process, watching justice being served in a way, and the process was fascinating to me. So it was from that experience that not only because I thought it was fascinating, but I thought this is the way that you can advocate for people's rights. This is a way to get justice. This is a way to use the system and to get some changes where people were being treated unfairly, where there were unfair labor practices, to get the representation that both the union owed to its membership and to get the company to treat and to follow the collective bargaining agreement.
Wonderful. So many busy professionals, veterinarians, healthcare providers, and lawyers all experience burnout, stress, and overwhelm in our daily lives. What are three tips that you might have for busy professionals to live from a life that they would absolutely love living?
I think the first and the most important thing really is to have clarity about what a person would really love in their life, not looking at their current existing conditions, but what would they really love in the area of their health and well-being, in the area of their relationships, in the area of their vocation or their time and money freedom. Because too many people, I think, are living from where their current situation is, and it's hard to get the clarity or to see beyond that. So I think once they have the clarity and have a vision of where they would like to be, let's say in 2 or 3 years, and to live from that vision as opposed to where they're living right now. So certainly having clarity as to what they really love and what they would love in their life is important. The second most important thing, I think, is to make a decision. It's not when I'm ready or later when I have the money or when I have the time. It's like make a decision to do whatever they can with what they have and where they are right now. And then finally, I think that once people make a decision to do something that's outside their comfort zone, and if they're not uncomfortable, then the growth isn't big enough, then I think they really need to befriend their fear, because the fear is going to come up and say, you can't do this. Who do you think you are? You're not ready. So in whatever the area of life it is. And so those would be three things that I would say that as a transformational coach that people should definitely look at to begin with. And those are the three basic foundations of becoming, living the life that you would love. There are other tips like just breathing, being in the present moment. This might sound funny, but too many lawyers, and it happens to me, don't want to like break the workflow to even go to the bathroom. Like they just keep on working, right? It's like, take that break, right? To breathe and to not, when you get into overwhelm, just to notice what you're noticing. If you're feeling really constricted, notice that. Take some deep breaths. If you're feeling expansive, then you're in the flow. But just to really be the awareness that people have is so critical in how they perform and what they're doing. I think having quiet time to stop all that chatter in their head is really, really important. So those are a few of the things. I think there's a lot more that we could probably talk about, but those are some of the things that I think in general, any professional could relate to.
Absolutely. And I know for sure my colleagues in the veterinary profession share exactly the same things. We're not taking time to drink water, to breathe, to eat lunch, to go to the bathroom. So just some real basic human needs that are being overlooked on a daily basis as we're rushing around. And I love having this conversation about how actually slowing down and giving ourselves more space can actually help us to be more productive. There's research study after research study shows that the most productive individuals work for 50 minutes and take a 15-minute break. So, you know, we do know that taking 30 seconds here and there definitely will only help us and help us to serve others more fully for sure. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Well, I love what you just said about working for 50 minutes and taking the break. I mean, that's part of what Brennan Burchard and the high performance coaching has really encouraged people to do, to set your alarm and after 50 minutes, stand up, walk around, go to the water fountain, just to break that intense concentration so that you can work more fully and more productively.
Yes, yes. And so for those of us who are entrepreneurs, or I know you have a passion for having a heart-centered business. So can you share some insights around having a heart-centered business and how having a heart-centered business can give each day more meaning and actually have less stress?
Absolutely. So when I say heart-centered, it's really listening to the wisdom of the heart. Too often in our work as scientists or as lawyers, we focus so much on the logical, the left side of our brain, whereas the right side of our brain, which is the more creative, the more intuitive side, doesn't get as much credit. We don't listen to it often enough. So lawyering from the heart for me has just really meant listening to my clients, not only for what they're saying, but for their expressions, for how their body language, and to really honor and to really respect what they're saying and the experience that they're having and not judging. In the beginning of my law practice, I have to admit that I would data mine. Like I had to get this information. And yes, I heard their stories. But now, as a heart-centered lawyer, I listen and can appreciate their stories. There's more trust. There's more compassion. There's more connection, so that even if I can't do anything for them, they're going to leave the office feeling better than when they came in, because there was that human connection. And It just helps with productivity. It helps me go when I'm too tired to continue going sometimes, to go that extra mile. But you think about the people that you're representing, and it makes a difference. And again, the heart has wisdom. We need to be able to listen to that and to tap into that. And the result of that will be more honesty, more truthfulness, just more connection in working with the client. I think that if we were more heart-centered, our world would be in a much better place, because we would be less judgmental. And we would see, even when working with judges and with trial attorneys, they're just doing their job. But if we start having negative reactions to them, or calling them names, or being angry, we're just putting all that negative energy out there. Those emotions come up, but it's just important to also remember that they're also trying to do their job as well, even though we don't agree with them.
And that's such a great point, that even when we disagree, we should always recognize, like, where is that person coming from, or, you know, embrace some diversity of opinion, and at the same time figure out, like, where can we come together, and where can we move the world forward as a collective group of people. So yeah, I really appreciate that insight in recognizing that, you know, sometimes we agree and sometimes we don't. And let's, if we all work together for the common good, we would all move collectively forward with that purpose.
If you look at what's happening right now in the world, and in particular in this country, lawyers don't have a very good reputation, right? They're seen as being greedy and money grubbing, and you can't really trust them. And yet we expect our clients to trust us. So our clients don't come to us because they're happy and they want to celebrate. They're coming to us because they have a problem. And the immigrants that I work with make mistakes not because they're bad people, but just because they don't understand the law. They don't understand the process to immigrate to the U.S. for, you know, to a large extent. And so they come here, they work, they pay their taxes, and then they find somebody that they're in love with. And for too many of them, they can't stay together unless the spouse goes back to country of birth for 10 years. So we have a system right now that really needs to be overhauled. It's way past due, and the laws need to be implemented as they are meant to be implemented by congressional intent. And so we have politics that play too big a part in this process. And what we see happening in 2020, I've never experienced this in the years that I've been doing this. And I've been doing this since the 80s, right? So yeah, we're in unprecedented times. Asylum seekers, it's pretty sad.
And that was part of why I asked you here, because as part of this podcast this year, I have launched a portion of it to also be a voter resource guide for 2020, and also a resource to political candidates and elected officials. Can you share any insight from your perspective around what you feel are some policy changes needed at the federal level to be able to more effectively and fairly work with immigrants, either in seeking asylum in the U.S. or with citizenship or other issues that you might see?
Well, immigration reform has been something that I have been actively involved in since 1997. We thought we almost had it in 2001. The issues that we have right now are that we have an immigration system that doesn't fit our economy. The immigration law that we have right now was passed in 1952, and we've had a lot of that 68 years, right? So we've had a lot of changes that have happened as a result of that, but they've been piecemeal changes, and some of them have been retroactive and some of them are, you know, for the future. But one of the biggest issues that we have right now, I think, that affect a lot of immigrants is a law that was passed in 1996 that basically said, if you've been in the United States for longer than 1 year, and you entered without permission, and then you leave the United States, even if you're married to a U.S. citizen, even if you have U.S. citizen children, even if you've been here for a long, long time, you can't come back into the United States for 10 years. You might hear phrases like unlawful presence. So that's what that is. It's about unlawful presence, people that have accumulated time here over a year and then leave and then cannot come back in for 10 years. Unless they can show that their U.S. citizen spouse would suffer a lot. So much of our system is about suffering. So the 3 and the 10-year bars or unlawful presence are certainly something that we have been advocating for change, because that would affect so many people's lives. And it would family unity and the health of the children and the PTSD that children are suffering because they're afraid that their mommies or daddies might be taken away, especially in this climate, but not only now, it's been that way for so many years. I had a client once who had a 12-year-old undocumented immigrant from Mexico. His 12-year-old son was in the back seat of the car. Dad was driving the car. And the little guy says, "Ay, papi, papi." And the father says, "Que pasa, what's going on? Ay, papi, la policía." There was a police car behind him. And the child was so afraid that there was a police car behind him that he was alarmed, right? And so the fear of police, the fear of law enforcement affects the kids. And you have families where there may be one child who's a U.S. citizen and one that isn't. It's a tough situation. So that change alone would affect a huge number of people. It would be an incredible change if people in Congress would have some backbone and just take a look at what can we do now to change things. The other really, really important change that has been covered a lot has been DACA, which stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Now, we've always had deferred action in our immigration laws. It's for humanitarian purposes. And so President Obama said, look at these kids that have come in before they were 16 years old and are here. They're persons of good moral character. They don't have any arrests. They've learned English. They're in school. They've been here continuously. Because we don't have any changes in our law, let's use what we have and create the system that's called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And basically, it gave kids a chance for the first time in their lives to be here and to work legally and to get social security numbers, to get driver's license, to be licenses, to be contributing members of society. And so it still doesn't give them legal status. So I had this amazing, amazing young man who was going to graduate from high school. He was at the top of his class, worked hard. I had done a community program back in Virginia, and I interviewed him in front of the community, and he said, "So this must feel great. Look at, got a driver's license, you got your social security number. You must be so happy." And he looked at me with sad eyes and shook his head and said, "No." I said, "What do you mean no?" He said, he thought he was a U.S. citizen all this time. So when he was applying for colleges, he realized that they weren't going to accept him. And for him and for so many other thousands of young people, they never know when it can be taken away. So imagine being here since you were 2 or 3 years old and then being sent back, because that's what this administration is talking about doing at this point, sending them back to a country that they don't know, where there's no family. So that's DACA. So really, we need to provide a way for them to get lawful permanent resident status so that they're not going to be deported. And then eventually, if they wish, to apply for citizenship. So that's another really, really big one. The third one is just to clarify for the audience or for people that don't quite understand how it works. There's a confusion as to lawful permanent residence, where people get their green card, and then citizenship, right? So some people think, and they may even be told erroneously when they get their driver's licenses, that they can vote or that they can register to vote. The simple act of registering to vote is a felony and can get you deported. And there's no forgiveness for it. There's no waiver. There's no pardon for it. So only people who are U.S. citizens or who have naturalized, who have waited for a period of time and then became a U.S. citizen, they are the only ones that can vote. And so this is a time where we want to make sure that everybody understands. So that's another really, really big one. In terms of asylum, we already have, the asylum law is pretty clear, right? If you're fleeing your country because you're afraid you're going to be persecuted based on 5 different enumerated areas, or your family's been tortured and you're seeking refuge, you're allowed to apply for asylum. But the laws have been so twisted right now that they're making people wait in Mexico under some horrendous conditions, women being raped, children being taken from their parents where they're waiting to get their interview or their court date at the in the United States. So asylum has really been torn apart and needs to be reinstated. They need to follow the color of the law and not be operating by executive order or by tweaking how it's implemented. The immigration law is the immigration law. The Immigration and Nationality Act is what controls. But if they're not following the law and if they're implementing it in ways that aren't intended to be implemented, there have been a lot of challenges that have helped that. So asylum has really been a very, very sad, pitiful area. Those are the biggest areas. The other big areas are just how we how we allow people to come into work, right, as non-immigrants, and then the immigrant categories. And so we have a lot of agricultural workers. What would we do without agricultural workers? But there's a lot of people doing agriculture that don't have visas. And they're the ones that are really suffering now because of COVID-19, right? So we just need to reorganize how we're doing our, how we implement and enforce our immigration laws. And ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has been out there gathering people up at a time where in the detention facilities, they're not being protected from COVID. You know, children are still being separated from their parents. What I mean, so if you look at our immigration policy, really should be a, we should be looking at family unity. That's like the cornerstone of our laws. But family unity seems to have gone by the wayside. And what many in Congress are pushing for now is to have a number system by whether you speak English, whether you have an education. And so you would get points for the qualities that they think are most important. Like Canada has that system, it has a point system as opposed to the family and the employment system. So those are some of the big areas that I think really need to be looked at carefully.
So you mentioned something right at the beginning of this conversation. And so I'm just curious, because we know Congress passes the laws and they do the legislation side of things. And then the laws go through and are, I don't want to say enforced, but you know, there are agencies then in the federal and state governments that implement the laws through rules and regulations. And so you alluded to something early on. And so my question was, you know, in addition to the policy changes, are there areas where we need to look at how the laws are being implemented, or is there anything that can be done there? Or is it simply that Congress on the federal side needs to clarify that policy so that things are implemented in the spirit in which they were intended?
That's a good question, Angela. So we have the Immigration and Nationality Act. That's the cornerstone, you know, 1952. We've had a number of amendments to that since that time that have changed how some, tweaked some areas of law, made some other changes, such as those 3 and the 10-year bars, the unlawful presence bars. And then we have the regulations, which is what implements the Immigration and Nationality Act. It implements the law, right? So that's in the Code of Federal Regulations. We've had that for a long time. What's happened is that courts have been tweaking away and looking at words, and what does this word really mean, and what does entry mean, and what does admissibility mean, and what is an admission, and looking at, so what, in what ways are people, what's good moral character, right? And changing those parts of it. So that's Congress that already has the regulations, but then it's the courts that start tweaking how they're going to enforce the laws and how they're going to read the laws and interpret the laws. And so it's at the court level, and we don't really have a separation between like normal courts and immigration courts and the appellate courts. And then we have things like, where does each administration want to put their efforts? This administration wants to build a wall, right? This administration wants to deport as many people as possible. Not to say that President Obama didn't also have a high number of deportations, right? So, but there has to be a humanitarian part to all of this and how we implement it. And so we have it. Like for some countries where there's been a lot of civil unrest, we've granted them temporary protected status. And for example, now, we have also some bans on Muslims, and we have bans on some countries by executive order for reasons in the public interest or the public policy, and that's at the executive level. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. And so I just think this is a really great way to highlight for the audience and the listeners out there how incredibly complicated this is when we start looking at the policy and what Congress can do. And then you look at the regulations, the CFR, and how that policy is implemented from a practical level. And then we go a step further to the court system, where you've got clients, you're representing your clients, and they're going before the courts. And so all of these details are then being parsed out in various different ways. And then it may go on to an appeals court, or would that be the appellate court system? and on and on it goes.
Right. So the you're absolutely right. So the Board of Immigration Appeals would be hearing any appeals from the immigration court, but that's all being overseen by the department of, or by the Department of Justice. So there isn't a lot of separation between the Attorney General has his idea and in fact just came out with a decision wanting to review an asylum case. Like that's not really the purview of the U.S. Department of Justice unless you want to establish bad, or depending on what side you're on, bad precedent for immigrants, right? So by having the Attorney General and Department of Justice at that level be reviewing cases, and they want to look at everything as opposed to some maybe discretionary parts of the decision, that totally impacts our asylum system. And so the precedents are going to affect our cases, both at the BIA, at the Board of Immigration Appeals level, and then if they get appealed to an appellate court, like the circuit courts, again, that again is going to make it even more complicated because some circuit courts might be more friendly to immigrants than other appellate courts. And so some cases, unless there's an injunction against the whole United States, those cases may only be applicable in that particular circuit. It gets very complicated. It does. And I think what further complicates it is that you have the Department of Homeland Security now that oversees USCIS, that now oversees Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that now oversees Customs and Border Patrol. And we didn't have that. We did not agree with those changes back when they were happening. I think it was in the early 2000s. But that, or maybe it was after 2001, right? Because of 9/11.
Yep. DHS got stood up after 9/11 for sure. And so this is also a great issue to think through the three different branches of government and how the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the court systems, right, are all separate that way. So just highlighting that as well, because the justice system is, you know, the third branch of our government. So I just really like to sort of highlight that for our listeners as well as we discuss some of these really complicated topics that we're seeing play out in the news throughout this whole year, quite frankly. And so I really appreciate your background and experience and expertise, Danusha, on that as well. And I just have one last burning question that I know all the busy professionals out there want to learn. How do you manage the stress that must come with being an immigration lawyer and how slowly the process moves for your client?
It's one moment at a time. It's one moment at a time, and it's just having the awareness that this is a moment in time. This, what happens to my clients, I have a lot of compassion for. But this is their lifetime. This is what is happening in their lifetime. I can do whatever I can to assist them, and I do my best, right? I'm a competent, compassionate, zealous advocate, but they also make choices, right? So I never want to get into pity for my clients because our life is a result of choices. How do I avoid stress? I breathe. I go to the bathroom when I have to. I don't react, which has been crucial for me, to take time to respond thoughtfully as opposed to reacting. And it takes practice. It doesn't happen automatically. But if I can just remember that, just take a deep breath. Don't say the first thing that comes out of my mouth or that comes out of my head, because words matter. And I can't take back the words, and I can't take back the impact of them or how they might hurt somebody. Just to be aware, just to have notice what I'm noticing, live in the present moment, and to really believe that there are better times coming forth.
Yeah. And I love that statement of really being present in the present moment and then being aware, right? Creating awareness around what are those triggers that will set you off to say maybe something we wish we could take back or however it may be for us. And when we're feeling stressed, to recognize what that is so that when we start to feel that creep in, we can then take a positive action to stop it in its tracks. So thank you for bringing that up so I could share my little insights and tips around that as well, Danusha.
Your insights were right on, and I'm totally with you. Taking that deep breath, everything that you said, we're on the same wavelength. It's so, so important to be in the moment right now. And just to remember that all the negative energy that we put out when we're thinking negative thoughts and anger, like it's out there. and maybe the energy might be a whole nother another conversation, but I really, really enjoyed being with you today, Angela.
Oh, thank you so much. And where are the voter resources if people are interested in learning more about current U.S. immigration policy?
There's a great resource, the Immigration Policy Center. I don't have the site right in front of me, but I can send that to you.
Okay, great. And we'll be sure to add those to the show notes for anyone who's interested in following up and learning more. So now I think it's time for our five questions segment. Are you ready?
I think so. Bring it on.
All right. So for question number one, we know that the most successful and happy people have a morning or evening routine or both. What do you do each morning or evening that sets your day up for success?
I love my mornings. I love to get up early. I love to stretch. I love to read something that inspires me. I love to journal. And I love to just have some quiet time, just meditate with a cup of coffee. And walking in the morning, I live close to the beach. So walking on the beach or just walking in my beautiful neighborhood, just getting some fresh air.
Yes, I love that quiet time and walk in the morning as well outside. So definitely with you there. And for questions number two and three, I really love separating these questions out because so often we like to conflate the idea of success and happiness, that once I achieve this X success, then magically I will be happy. And we just know from the research that that simply isn't true. So first off, what's your definition of success?
When I'm congruent, living my purpose, and doing what I was born to do in this world. Because when I'm doing that, then everything else flows. So that's my definition of success in my relationships, in my work, in my health and wellness, and in my time and money freedom. So basically, when I'm feeling at peace, that inner peace, just having that inner knowing that I am doing, even if it's not comfortable, and even if it's not always easy, and even if I don't get the financial abundance at that time, there's goodness. And that's my definition of success. I'm happy.
Wonderful. And so then what's your definition of happiness?
Happiness for me is when I can let go and just be free. Happiness is knowing that everything is going to be okay. Happiness for me is being able to laugh, being able to spend time with friends, being able to inspire others. It's just that feeling inside that makes you just kind of want to giggle. So happiness for me is an inside job, but it's just one of joy, of just really appreciating all that I have, all the blessings that I have in the moment. Looking at squirrels, looking at birds, right? That gives me, I feel this happiness. I just feel this joy.
Well, I am definitely inspired by those answers, and I'm sure everyone else is as well. For question number four, what do you know now that you wish you would have known 10 years ago?
Well, where do I start? How much time do we have? you know what? I think what I wished I would have known 10 years ago was the importance of being more heart-centered and the importance of focusing. I grew up thinking that the way to do things was to multitask. I now know that it does incredible damage to your brain and to your productivity. So focusing, completing one project at a time, I wish that I would have known that and would have lived my life accordingly 10 years ago. I'm glad I got it now, though.
Yes, I love that. Just totally focus on one thing, SWAT team it, get it done, and move forward to what that next thing is. And if it's all jumbled up in my brain, I like to put it all out on paper and say, okay, what's first?
Angela, I've got to admit that I'm a work in progress on that one. Fortunately, my staff is very organized. They like to complete work and they keep me on my toes. But man, it's still a challenge. It's been many years that I've been operating out of the other system. So, but I'm working on it. Getting better all the time.
Thank you so much for sharing that, because I think so often we feel like, oh, you know, I've talked to all these amazing people and they've got it all together. They've got it all figured out. And I'm right there with you. Like, we are all learning and growing each and every day. In fact, that's the two questions I ask myself at the end of every day is, what did I learn today and how did I serve today?
Oh, I love that.
It really keeps me focused and growing and learning and getting better. in a positive way, not like an overwhelming sort of way.
No, that's great though, because it makes you, it causes you to reflect on the day. It makes you feel good about what you got done. It helps set you up for the next day to see what else you can do, but you've already taken care of this part of it. So you can put that to sleep with you.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I love that. I love thinking about it that way.
I love that. Yes.
And for question number 5, what do you think is the biggest issue facing busy professionals today?
I think the biggest issue facing professionals today, especially today, is probably stress and not living their life purpose, not being in alignment. That may be a little judgmental. So I would maybe go back and just say the stress and not taking care of themselves.
Well, I can share with you and the listeners, I was in a veterinary conference in a talk about wellness just this last week. And the speaker asked, how many of y'all have a purpose statement, a mission statement, you know, something like that. And out of everybody that was in that seminar, it was 8 people. So for over 50 people, 8 had a purpose statement. Wow. And so I do wonder, and I would love to continue to explore this and continue to ask people, like, A, do you have a purpose statement? And are you living in alignment with that every day? Because something I just love is touch your dreams every day. And for me, it's like really getting centered around my purpose. And then I have a good day. But if I forget to do that in the morning, man, I am doing this and that and all these tasks, and they're just on the to-do list. And at the end of the day, I'm like, what did I do? Did I serve my purpose? Did I touch my dream?
That you just reminded me of, and I thank you for that, is to think about the 3 words of who you want to show up as that day. Like, how do I want to be on this day? How do I want to be? What's my mindset? What's my intention? And I meant to say that earlier, but yes, that's such a great practice for people to get into, because if you think about it and then do what you do, Angela, which is to look back on your day and say, what was my mindset like? What did I achieve what I wanted to achieve today? Those are great tips right there. Really great tips, Angela.
Well, Danusha, I have learned so much from you today, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. So thank you so much for joining us and sharing all this great information with us today.
It has been my pleasure. You know that I think that maybe doctors maybe and lawyers are at the highest risk of suicide and depression. So sharing this information is just really, really helpful. I love the work that you're doing. Thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this today. It was a true pleasure.
That's all the time we have for this week's episode of Beyond the Stethoscope. I hope you are inspired to take actionable steps towards accomplishing your goals and living your dreams.